behind bees are packing up their belongings and getting out. And once the tanks start firing, to be able to get any of their stuff out. So they're just trying to get their families out safely now. What the Israeli soldiers did last night is they came into the camp and started planting mines in the houses, and they climbed up to the rooftops and opened fire into the houses that had people living in them. And so this is a bad day for the people in this area, certainly. It's common, but it's still devastating for every individual that has to live through it here. Recently, I just wanted to let you know that some international people and Palestinian people together were able to get into Mawasi Rafah, an area that's been closed for 2 years. So there's something happening here every now and again, but anyone who's trying to resist at all has opened fire at the Israeli military today. When the people were trying to get their belongings out of their houses, opened fire on them. They ruptured more sewage lines, and when the workers were trying to repair them, they opened fire on them. All that's happening here is the Israeli government is trying to destroy all of the Palestinian people that live here. They're not just stopping to build this hideous 8-meter high and 10-meter deep separation wall. They're demolishing homes and driving the people away so far into the town that it has nothing to do with this wall anymore. They're just trying to decimate this entire area. And when they do destroy the houses, they bury them under the ground, covering up their crime so it looks as if no one ever lived here.
Now, with these latest house demolitions, as you said, the house were unoccupied. I guess it is having its intended effect of putting fear and apprehension in the minds and the heart of the people.
Absolutely. People are afraid. And now many people are feeling that they've got nothing left to save except for possibly their lives.
You say
and
that,
the lives of their families.
You say that you are close to the border of with Egypt. Is that border open between the territories and Egypt, or is it a closed border?
It's closed. It's of course controlled by the Israeli military government, as all borders in and out of Palestine are. There are fences and walls in much of the area, and now there's this bigger wall that's being built.
And the wall does the wall also run along the border with the occupied territory and Egypt? Is that the situation?
It has been. I mean, it already is there. Now it's just coming along the bottom, all the way along the south, and it's heading west. They started at Saladin Gate, and now they're moving west like a monster that won't stop growing.
So
we take a look at it just longer.
And so I would take it that what this has done is it would make it impossible for people, if they wanted to flee the area as the fighting and the repression intensify, for them to use that as a way out. Is there any sense that the Egyptians would welcome Palestinians fleeing from the occupation into Egypt?
So far, the Palestinians are not able to get out. When there was a young man who actually wanted to leave because he was fearful of going into the prison, and instead of being able to be allowed out through any kind of channel, the Israeli military stormed his house with 50 soldiers and took him out of his room while he was sleeping. And now he's been given 6 months administrative detention, which means he's in the prison without charge, without trial, for 6 months, which can be renewed every 6 months. This is a common practice that the military display. They keep the political prisoners they have now locked up in their Israeli prisons.
Well, Kristen, I want to thank you for joining us this morning and to continue to update us here on Wake Up Call and what's taking place in the occupied territory. You can stay with us if you like, because now we're going to be switching over to Peres Kedron, an independent journalist in Israel who has reported over the years here on Pacifica Radio and WBAI. He is one of the leaders of YesGov, which is, I don't know if I'm saying that right, YesGov, which is the movement of the reservist soldiers who have refused to serve in the occupied territory. Perez Cadron, could you give us some background on the individuals who have and why they have refused to serve in the occupied territories, and the ruling and the reasoning behind this ruling by an Israeli court? Good morning.
Well, it's, I'm pleased to tell you that it's no longer a matter of individuals. We're talking about over 1,000 refuseniks in several different groups. There's now a website with the names of over 1,000 individuals who have either refused already or committed to refuse if and when they're sent to the occupied territories. Now, the motivation is quite simple. Yeah, of course, it's different from each one, but basically it's what they share is a feeling of the senselessness and the brutality of the occupation, which, as we put out in one Yeshvul leaflet, the heading was, "The occupation is a disaster for both peoples." And that indeed is the fact, and that's why many soldiers, reservists and regular soldiers, are reporting for duty, and they say you'll do anything that's legitimate, but serving in the occupied territories is not legitimate and has nothing to do with the defense of Israel. On the contrary, it's harmful to the interests of the state of Israel.
Now, in the past, you've had individuals, as you say, it's up to 1,000 now, who have refused. What has been the punishment that these individuals have met?
Well, the interesting thing, I've been involved with the refusal movement for 30 years now, since it started in the early 70s. And there hasn't been a single case of a refusenik being court-martialed. Now, to anyone who's familiar in any way with an army, any army, the idea of hundreds of soldiers, there are now some many hundreds of soldiers who refuse, flagrantly refuse orders, walked right up to their superior officers and said, "I refuse to do this." And the fact that there have been hundreds who have done this, who have committed this very grave offense according to traditional military thinking, and not a single one has been court-martialed. They've all been tried by what the army calls disciplinary procedure, which is the sort of thing you get, you know, if you turn up on parade, you forgot to shave, or you came back half an hour late from your furlough, so you're going to a commanding officer and he gives you 7 days in detention. That is the kind of trial that they've been getting. Now, the reason for this is that the army is scared stiff of what we call the Black Flag Principle. The Black Flag Principle says that a soldier who receives an order which is flagrantly illegal, namely the definition laid down by Israeli judges many years ago, an order over which flies a black flag of illegality, when the order is illegal, the soldier is entitled, is required to refuse it. Now, if the army should ever be bold enough to take a refusal before court, his argument will be that the service in the occupied territories, the specific operations that he was asked to take part in, are flagrantly illegal, and therefore the trial would be turned from a trial of the refusal to a trial of the army, in which the army would have to defend and justify its actions in the occupied territories. That is a confrontation that the Israeli army, which is very redoubtable, very courageous on many fronts, this is a confrontation that the Israeli army has avoided consistently for the past 30 years. Now, a number of refuseniks soldiers were called up, refused to serve, and were sentenced by a disciplinary procedure. And they said, "Hey, we want to present our case." You know, disciplinary procedure, I forgot to mention, it's a simple 2-3-5 minute procedure. You go in and the complaint is read out, you're allowed to say something in your defense and in your sentence. That's the whole trial. And these guys said, "No, we want to present our side of the case. We can only do that in a court." So they appealed to the army to allow them to be court-martialed. Now, again, anyone with any familiarity with military procedure knows that no soldier in his right mind asks to be court-martialed, because there he can get much heavier sentence. But nevertheless, these soldiers took the risk, they demanded to be court-martialed, and the army turned them down. So they appealed to the Supreme Court, asking the Supreme Court to order the army to put them on, to court-martial them. Can you imagine the procedure? And the Supreme Court backed up the army, and instead of relating specific petition as they're being presented to it, went into a long philosophical discussion about this whole concept of refusal, which of course they condemned and rejected. So in a way, the army has come out with something of a tactical victory, but that doesn't alter the fact that that there are now something like 15 soldiers in military prisons for refusing to serve in the occupied territories. The number in prison since the beginning of the Intifada is now in the vicinity of 200. And tomorrow, hundreds of supporters will go up on the mountain overlooking the military prison for a vigil of support. This is organized by Yeshiv Wall in support of the refusals who are in the military prison at Aklik. I don't know whether many of your listeners would be able to attend, but it's a very colorful carnival kind of occasion when we go up on the hillside. And we put on a show for the prisoners down below in the military jail to show them that they're supported and their self-sacrifice is valued.
Well, you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. We're talking to Perez Padron from, we're talking to you from Jerusalem?
That's right.
Okay, and a long-time correspondent here with Pacifica Radio, and...
Since early 1974, shortly after the Yom Kippur War, I started reporting for BAI, and then generally for Pacifica, so I was deeply offended when somebody asked me how I introduced myself. I didn't think I had to introduce myself on BAI, but I gather that's part of the game.
Well, we always have new people coming in, and as well as new listeners who may not be familiar with you and the work that you have done and how it fits in with what's going on here at Pacifica, a radio station that examines the issues of war and also work more closely with exploring ways of making sure that we live in a peaceful world. Now, normally when you have conscientious objector, we usually think of conscientious objectors as people who object to all war. But even within the United States, some people can understand that they're selective conscientious objectors. There are some people who object to carrying a weapon, while there are some who object to even carrying a stretcher. Others would carry the stretcher. Others would work in other service towards the military or towards the military objective. This is the argument, if I hear, that has been rejected in this case, that you can't selectively object to the kind of war or the nature of the combat that you may face. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Yeah, no, I need to correct you. The selectivity doesn't relate to the form of duty. I mean, whether you're peeling potatoes in a kitchen or shooting in a firing range or whatever. The objection is basically political, very often geographical. In the past, there were many soldiers who refused to take part in the Lebanon War. They refused to cross the border into Lebanon. And that is actually one of the origins of the name Yesh Gvul, which means there is a border, I will not cross, I mean to say. And now most of the refusals simply say they refuse to serve in the occupied territories. They refuse to cross what we call the Green Line, the pre-67 border of Israel, while as part of their military service. And this is a clear political decision, just as there were attempts at selective refusal. We don't call it collective conscientious objection, because these are people who have served in the army, continue to serve in the army, and under present circumstances have no argument with the existence of the army. On the contrary, you'd be surprised to hear, for instance, that the Yeshua is very strongly in favor of conscription. We're very worried by the idea of a volunteer army, which essentially sooner or later becomes an army of Nazis and mercenaries. So we believe in the army, but we believe that the army should be confined to its legitimate defensive duties. And when a soldier feels that he's being asked to do something that has nothing to do with the defense of his country, rather it has to do with defense of expansionism and domination of another people, and he says, I refuse to do this, this is a clear moral and political decision, objection on to a specific assignment, not objection to service in the army as such.
As a matter of fact, as a matter of fact, the New York Times, or one of the local papers in the United States, quoted individuals who were involved, soldiers who were involved in the organization Yeshivot, as saying that they refused to get involved in dominating, expelling, starving, and humiliating an entire people. A question, though, as conscientious objectors, they do not abandon the right to bear arms in a process of self-defense, in the process of defending one's life and the lives of one's family if they come under imminent attack. But United Nations and the war of law today, which all, I guess, civilized nations are supposed to sign up on, is that if a conflict occurs, that you defend yourself in the moment, but you seek redress through the international bodies. As Israel, it doesn't seem, however, that Israel right now is intent on taking its case to the international bodies or the international tribunal for adjudication.
No, of course not, because the self-defense is in the process of doing something illegal. It's like a burglar breaking into your house, and when you try to do something, he defends himself against you. Now, that, of course, is a non-legitimate self-defense, because he's defending himself in pursuance of something that's non-legal, non-legitimate. And we say that the whole occupation, 35 years of deprivation of the basic rights of the Palestinian people, the occupation itself is illegal, non-legitimate, and then any service that helps perpetuate that occupation is non-legitimate and non-legal. And that's why we support the individuals who say, yes, we'll continue to serve in the army, and if tomorrow Israel is attacked by an external aggressor, we'll defend Israel, but we won't defend the settlement, we won't defend the occupation, because this is non-legitimate. That's the distinction that's drawn between legitimate self-defense and defense that is not legitimate, because you're defending yourself while you're an intruder in the territory of somebody else.
Now, that leads me up to the impending election that will be taking place in Israel. As this argument surfaced within the election, the fact that Israel could live with its neighbors in secure borders, if they went back to the 1967 line. It seems now for some 30 years, Israel has been living at peace with Egypt, and it seems with others of its neighbors who have made peace with the Israelis. Now it seems that it's up to the Israelis to make peace with the Palestinians. Is this playing out in the election, or are we seeing continued talk of expelling all the Palestinians from the occupied territories?
Well, it's not either or. These are opposing points of view. They're the hardline parties of the right, which speak almost openly of mass deportation of Palestinians, or encouraging them to emigrate by all kinds of means, like making their lives a misery until they decide to pull up stakes and go. On the other hand, there is the peace movement. There are various pro-peace parties, orientation stronger or weaker, This is definitely an important issue in the election, so other issues, it's been an important issue in every election for the past 20 years. Ever since the peace agreement with Egypt, the question of Palestinians has been on the agenda, and it's been ducked and evaded, and no real decision has been made. On the contrary, the Israelis perpetuating its hold with the establishment of settlements in occupied territories. But in these elections, the interesting thing is that this main topic, which has, as I say, been a main topic for many years, is overshadowed now by one or two other issues. One of them, for instance, is massive vote rigging and buying within the ruling party, the Likud party of Ariel Sharon. And there's increasing evidence coming out that criminal elements are active there, that votes have been bought and sold at various deals involving some quite prominent individuals. And the fingers are pointing higher and higher now. There's a deputy minister under investigation and most likely will be dismissed. And there's even talk that something's going to go to Sharon's son and go to the president, the state president, who's a figurehead role, but nevertheless important. So the issue of money buying power is a very hot one, and it's overshadowing the other issues. So we still have 4 weeks to go, and I'm sure that everything will come up.
Well, it seems also now that the Likud party, while they're expected to retain power, that they will be losing some seats. I hear there's some scandal going on.
On the contrary.
They're going to pick up seats?
Yeah, they're going to pick up seats, but they're not going to pick up as many as they had hoped.
Okay.
At the moment, in the present census, if I remember, they had 19 seats, and they were promised at one stage that they would double that up to 40. And now the predictions are that they won't get much above 30, and these are all votes that they've lost in the past week and 10 days since the corruption scandal erupted. But
could you talk to us a little bit about the corruption scandal and what it entails? Tell us about the corruption scandal.
Well, it's simply that when the Likud chose its list of candidates, we vote by party, and each party presents a slate. Now, it's not enough to be a candidate of a party. You have to be high up on the list, high up enough, so that if that party is going to get 5 seats, it's not going to be any good to be number 7, because you won't get a seat. You have to be in the first 5 places to make sure that you're going to get in. So the scramble was to get as high up as possible on the list. And some very surprising outside candidates that nobody had ever heard of before have landed up in very safe slots, high up on the list, and it turns out that they were supported by some very dubious underworld figures who simply brought in hundreds of votes and got them in, whereas some people, including some very close associates of Sharon himself, found themselves way down too far down on the list to ever hope of entering of getting elected. So there are very murky dealings, and they're beginning to emerge now. And every day the media carry reports of senior figures in the Likud party being summoned in by the police for interrogation.
And who's the highest?
They're pointing fingers at one another.
And how high up does it go?
Well, the latest the talk is that we have to go back sometimes. At one stage, Netanyahu, the former prime minister, was staging a very strong challenge to Sharon. And Sharon met that challenge by getting thousands of people to join the party and vote for his people. That was the way it was done. And it's believed that his son, Omri, who is another murky figure behind the scenes, was heavily involved in getting these thousands and thousands of people to jump onto the Likud bandwagon at the very last moment, join the party, and therefore have a right to vote in the primaries. And this is how Sharon faced off the challenge from Netanyahu. And apparently, in the course of bringing in these people, either as individuals or as groups, money changed hands. four votes. And Likud candidates at the selection protest reported that they were approached by what they call vote contractors who offered so many votes at $300 a head. You want 100 votes, okay? You pay this sum of money, $30,000, and we'll get you these votes. Now, that's in the Likud Central Committee, which has a membership of just under 3,000. So a couple hundred votes can make the difference between being in slot 15, where you're certainly being elected, or being in slot 32, where you're probably never going to see the Knesset on the inside.
Well, Peretz Kedron, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Peretz Kedron speaking to us from Israel, from Jerusalem. You are listening to WBAI. This is Wake Up Call. Good morning, Errol. Good morning, Rosalie. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Amy Goodman. It's good to see you. So now, tell me.